for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Kenny Rogers has sold close to 200 million records. That's pretty impressive for one of seven children raised by Floyd and Lucille Rogers in a Houston housing project. Kenny Rogers joins me here in the studio to talk about his new memoir. It details his life and a five-decade music career. It's titled Luck, or something like it. And you can join us. I know many of you are Kenny Rogers fans. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Kenny Rogers, it's so good to meet you.
Thank you so much. First of all, I'm one of eight children.
Eight?
Unless you're leaving one of them out. I don't know. One of them did deserve to be mentioned anyway.
I'm glad you're here.
I am too, and I appreciate you having me here.
I want you to know that before the show started, we got two tweets, one of which said, everywhere we went in Uganda, we heard Kenny Rogers. No kidding.
Wow.
He's huge there. And then another, what is it with Kenny Rogers in Africa? A friend in Kenya said the same thing.
You know, I don't know. I went to an Africa on a safari once, not a hunting safari, but a photographic safari with my wife and 10 other people. And we had this group of guys that took care of us. And every one of those guys ended up at the end of the thing with albums they wanted me to sign, which I thought was pretty cool.
So it must have gone viral, maybe.
I guess so, but they looked old, like they'd had them for a while. So
isn't that interesting? It does.
It fascinates me because I never take that for granted. You know, I go into a country and I figure I have to start from scratch, and I'm surprised that, you know, interestingly enough, someone told me once, I was talking to a guy from some bizarre country, I don't know what it was, and I said, how would you have ever heard my music? And they said, because before we had our own radio stations, National Public Radio used to come in here, and they used to play you a lot.
I love it.
So I have to give you credit.
I love it. Well, I want to ask you first about that first solo hit of yours, Lucille, and your mother's reaction.
Okay. You can play the song first. And
I want to hear a little bit about your mother, and then we'll work that song in.
Well, my mom, first of all, you have to know that I had recently told her about a song called Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town.
We're going to hear.
That was written by Mel Tillis because he wrote it about someone he knew. So I think my mom assumed all songs written were written about people they knew, and she assumed I had written the song. So she was all over me and saying, you know, how dare you do that?
How dare you do that? Let's hear.
Ever after, I'm after whatever the other life brings. In the mirror I saw him, and I closely watched him. Thought how he looked out of place. He came to the woman who sat there beside me. He had a strange look on his face. The big hands were calloused. He looked like a mountain. For a minute I thought I was dead. But he started shaking. His big heart was breaking. He turned to the woman and said, you picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille. With 400 children and a crop in the field.
I've had some bad times, lived through some sad times. This time you're hurting won't heal. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille.
love that voice.
You know, I appreciate that. You know, it's so funny. My mom, who was such an important part of my life, she used to tell people, they would say, well, what do you think about his success? And she, you know, that boy never worked a day in his life. All he ever did was sing. You know, it's like this isn't a job. But she was very proud, you know, and she was a very strong woman in the sense that, you know, she only had a third grade education. But she had so many important things to say in my life that I think really shaped who I am.
Time after time, you picked a fine time to leave me, Lucy, with four hungry children and a crop in the field. I've had some bad times, lived through some sad times. This time the hurting won't heal. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille.
Just wonderful. You know, when you think about the fact that your father was an alcoholic.
Right.
And you talk about that a lot in the book. You talk about the fact that when you begin to speak about your father, you identify him as an alcoholic. You say your mother really had to put up with a lot.
But you know what? One of the sad things about my life I've found is that I didn't know my father better. I mean, a friend of mine who was really a marriage counselor at one time, he said, every time you talk about your father, the first thing you say is he was an alcoholic. And he said, is that how you see him? I said, no, he was a very funny man. I've always said I get my sense of humor from my father and my sense of values from my mother. And it's a great combination. He was a great man, because if you go back and you look at those times, almost every man was an alcoholic. Hmm. They'd come out of World War II, where everybody worked at the shipyards, had a job. The jobs closed down after the war. He couldn't support his family. And that's got to be devastating. And then I think my mom kind of unintentionally but necessarily emasculated him. She, you know, he'd bring his check home. She would take it and hide it. Otherwise, he would go drink it up and the family would have nothing. And I think that was very devastating to him. So after having written the book and learned more about my father, I really regret that I didn't know him better as a man.
But what could she have done otherwise?
She had no choices. You know?
Exactly, because if he had taken that money and spent it on alcohol, what would you kids have done?
An alcoholic by nature means you don't have a choice. You know, he would have taken that money. He would have spent it. But he was kind of funny. He got smart. He'd bring his money home and he'd hide it. But he'd hide it when he was drunk. Then he couldn't find it when he was sober. So they'd have to go through the house looking for his money.
Now, you promised yourself you would never become either involved in alcohol or drugs. You did get tempted a couple of times.
Well, I played with it in the 60s, didn't everyone? But, you know, I was always worried about my ability to control it because of my dad. I worried if that was something that was predisposed to, if my dad was an alcoholic. And alcohol has just never interested me, except I had this big place in Athens, Georgia, and my wife used to love to throw parties and we'd get people.
Which wife?
Wanda. She's the only wife I
Your
talk about.
Your current wife.
Yeah, she's great. But we'd have these big parties, and they would all drink because we were staying on the property. And one night I thought I was drinking pina colada mix, you know, the pineapple. And about halfway through, she started spiking them. And after I had four, it was like something hit me in like a baseball bat. I realized I'm a lot more fun when I drink.
I think most people think they're
yeah,
a lot
that's probably
more
what
fun
it was.
When
I
they
thought
drink.
It was more fun.
I'm not sure they really are, but in any event, you actually in high school began forming your first band. You really were intense about wanting to create music.
Well, I just loved it. I went to see Ray Charles when I was 12, and I was struck by the fact that people laughed at everything he said and clapped for everything he sang. And I thought, wow, who wouldn't want to do that? I didn't even know I could sing at the time. But I started singing in church choirs and glee club in school. And my glee club teacher, Miss Lefesti, said, you know, you're really very good. You should do something with this, which I guess was the kind of the nexus for what I chose to do. But I started putting groups together because, you know, I learned really quickly that the guys in the groups got all the girls. So I was very one-dimensional at that time. Apparently, academics didn't mean a lot to me, but music was great.
And the friendship that you formed with the group was good, too.
Yeah, it was a bunch of guys that I went to church with, the first group. And we formed this little group, and we went around to sing at what at the time were called sock ops at the schools. So we'd go get on stage and sing, and, you know, and it was really a great time in my life because the people I associated with weren't troublemakers. So we spent all of our time getting better at what we had chosen.
Kenny Rogers, his new memoir is titled Luck or Something Like It. You can join us, 800-433-8850.
I feel just like a child without a home. The love you give me keeps me hanging on. Honey, all I ever need is you. You're my first love, you're my last. You're my future, you're my best. Oh, loving you is all I ask. Honey, all I ever need is you. Weather's coming.
And I'm sure many of you, if not all, recognize that voice, that wonderfully distinctive voice of Kenny Rogers. He's here in the studio with me. He's got a brand new memoir. It's titled Luck or Something Like It. He was raised in a housing project, one of 8 children in Houston, Texas. His father had drinking problems, shall we say. His mother was a stalwart who worked. She worked how many jobs?
She worked at the church in the nursery, and then she worked at the Rice Hotel cleaning rooms. She just worked everywhere. She was an amazing woman. She was a nurse's assistant at the hospital.
And yet, somewhere in your heart, you believe she emasculated your father.
And I'm not sure that's the right word.
She needed to deal with how to take care of you.
Well, sometimes reality is emasculating. You know, emasculating in the sense that he wanted to be the man but wasn't capable. And I think that really hurt him. And he knew that. But to my father's credit, he stayed with my mom until he died. And he didn't just run off and leave and find somebody else and do that. So I have to step back from him sometime and think about those qualities that he had. And he was funny. He was a hilarious man to be around. He made us laugh every night. And so you know, they each had their contribution to the family, but my mom's was stronger, you know. And my mom, I remember her going to all these jobs, and she told me once, son, she said, be happy where you are. Never be content to be there. But if you're not happy where you are, you'll never be happy.
Here's an email from Keith, who says, I was becoming a little disillusioned with rock music at about the same time Kenny Rogers switched to country. I'd like to know if Kenny Rogers had similar feelings for the direction rock music was taking at that time.
Well, I was accidentally rock. You know, in high school, there was a friend of mine named Mickey Newberry who did imbibe in the medications. And he wrote, just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. And I just loved the song. I thought it was so cool. So I asked him if I could record it. And he said he couldn't let me have it because Sammy Davis Jr. had it on hold. And I would have loved to have heard that record.
Oh, my goodness.
But, you know, we were never comfortable. The first edition was never comfortable being rock and roll, and we were never fully accepted. That song was so unique that it was played on rock radio. If you look back, we had songs like Reuben James, Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, and we had songs that were really country-oriented, and I've always been much more comfortable there.
And let's hear a little of Ruby.
You've painted up your lips and rolled and curled your tinted hair. Ruby, are you contemplating going out somewhere? The shadow on the wall tells me the sun is going down. Take your love to town. It wasn't me that started that old crazy Asian war, but I was proud to go and do my patriotic chore. And yes, it's true that I'm not the man I used to be. Some company.
Tell me about that song, because it created a lot of stir.
And it should have. You know, the 60s was a time where the public fought back. You know, before that, the music of the 30s and 40s was all what a wonderful world this is and how beautiful you look tonight. And about the 60s, people started saying, wait a minute, there's more to this life than that. But what's really interesting that I learned from that song is that if you do a hook to the song that's sing-alongable, if that's such a word, that people will sing it, and later they'll go, oh, my God, that's about a guy who's going to kill his wife. They don't realize it till after they already love the song.
But it's also about Vietnam.
It was actually written about the Korean War. It says Crazy Asian War. But I released it during the Vietnam War, so everybody assumed that's what it was. What it did that I think was fascinating is it took, you hear 10,000 people are killed, and you don't really relate to it. I mean, it's tragic, and we all know that. But when one guy comes back home and tries to reinsert himself into his life, and he has troubles, marriage problems, it puts the war on a one-to-one level, and we can all relate to that. And I think that was the beauty to that song.
And this poor man comes back injured.
Right.
And he's watching his wife go out the door.
Right.
And he's afraid he's losing her.
Yeah, and he's threatening in his mind at least to kill her. So that's what, you know, I've always done two types of songs. The first are songs that say what every man would like to say and every woman would like to hear. If you listen to the lady, she believes in me, you decorated my life through the years, all that. And the other are what I call social songs that have social conscience to them. You know, Coward of the County was about a rape, and I don't think people even realize that. they sing along with it, and they sing along, and then one day they look back and go, wait a minute, that's about a rape. Reuben James was about a black man who raised a white child. Ruby about the Vietnam War vet. So, I mean, I think you can do things. If you can make people like the music, they'll get the message. But if they don't like the music, they're not going to listen to the message.
Tell me about five marriages.
Great. What can I tell you? You know, it's interesting. I loved every woman I married.
Yeah, I know you did.
You cannot accuse me of not being able to commit. But it's what's really interesting, I think one of the things I realized in writing this book is there's a very fine line between being driven and being selfish. And I think I crossed that line a couple of times because subconsciously I wasn't saying I want to be successful at any cost, but I think I set out on a path that required me to be gone so much from home. And I don't care how much you love someone, if you're gone 5 or 6 months out of the year, you're going to disconnect. And I think once the marriage had run its course, it wasn't fair to everybody to do that. Do I wish I'd handled it differently? I wish I'd been more sensitive, if nothing else. Recently I've been watching a lot of television. I always have, but I've noticed how many kids are so screwed up because their parents got divorced. And I don't think I realized that. I thought, well, hey, she and I aren't getting along. I'm going to leave and she'll take care of the kid. And I must say, you know, my older boys are incredible people. So my wives did wonderful things for them.
And now you've been married for 20 years to Wanda.
We've been together 20 years, married for 15 years.
Uh-huh.
Just seemed like 20. I don't know.
And you've got twins?
8 years old.
Gosh.
Yeah, they say having kids at my age make you or break you. And right now I'm leaning heavily toward break.
Is that right?
But oh, it's such a great thing. You know, I regret, and I get choked up when I think about this, that I won't be here for that important part time in their life when they really need my help. So I took a couple of these books, and I signed one to Justin and one to Jordan. Yeah. And I said, maybe this will help you understand who I really was, you know, because otherwise they wouldn't know what I've been through to get where I've been. And I said, I expect great things from both of you. Don't let me down.
They won't.
I don't think they will.
They're
such good kids, and that I owe to Wanda. It's always the case, though. You know, men try as hard as they can, but they're always mama's boys. You know, I was. I know that.
One of my favorites has always been The Gambler.
Oh, yeah.
Were you a gambler?
You know, I used to gamble, and then I realized that I can't win enough to excite me, but I can lose enough to depress me, so I quit gambling.
Warm summer's evening. On a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns of staring out the window at the darkness till boredom overtook us. And he began to speak. He said, son, I've made a life out of reading people's faces and knowing what the cards were by the way they held their eyes. So if you don't mind my saying, I can see you're out of aces. For a taste of your whiskey, I'll give you some advice. So I handed him my bottle, and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bummed a cigarette and asked me for a light. And the night got deathly quiet, and his face lost all expression. Said, if you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
Every That's Dottie West singing in the background. It was, you know, that was a great time when she and I were kind of locked together professionally. And she loved singing on my records. I loved singing on her records. And it was just a thrill for me to be a part of that because she was a very special person.
Tell me about Dottie, because she died young.
Yeah, you know, and she had more problems than that. She had a business manager who stole all her money. I mean, it was several million dollars and just ran off with it. And so she was broke. And that hurt her more than anything else. The IRS came in and started taking her gold records off the wall, taking personal things. You know, and I guess that's what they do. But it just broke her heart. And she was a broken, broken woman at that time. So, you know, I had a deal with Dodge Chrysler, and I gave her one of my cars. I couldn't give it to her because if she owned it, they could get it. So I loaned it to her. And I think the day that she was going to the studios, the car wouldn't start. So, the older guy took her and they got in a car wreck. But
ugh.
I went to the hospital and I saw her. And she was barely distinguishable, the way she looked. And I held her hand and I said, Dottie, if you get out of this, we're going to do another duet. And they said she couldn't communicate, but I swear she squeezed my hand, you know.
You really do love doing duets.
I do. You know, I have this thing about duets. I think that it's like running the 100-yard dash. You get out and people say, run it as fast as you can. You run it as fast as you think you can. But you put someone alongside you who runs faster, and you are going to run faster. So that's the same thing with duets.
Kenny Rogers, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to your hometown, Houston, Texas.
Okay, good.
Good morning, Rhonda.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Kenny Rogers, I love your song. I am an African-American woman, and my middle name is Lucille.
Uh-oh. So the song was about you.
Okay.
We got to the bottom of that one.
And she probably should have left my grandfather. Didn't.
You know, life has some funny twists to it sometimes.
You bet.
And the trick is to take advantage whichever way it goes. I mean, my mom loved my dad. My dad loved my mom. That was a problem they had to deal with.
You're going to hear an interesting comment from Teresita, who's in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good.
I just wanted to tell Mr. Rogers that I was born in Cuba, and I came into this country when I was 7 years old. And when we first got to this country, we had three albums, and one of them was one of Kenny Rogers' albums, and that was the way we learned how to speak English.
Oh, that's child abuse, isn't it? To start them that early. You know, I've had so many people tell me that they learned to speak English because country music is simple. You know, if it hurts, you say it hurts. And I think that people learn to speak, you know, sentences through listening. They learn a song and then they find out what it means. But that's very nice and very flattering. And I really appreciate that.
You know, there is another element of sound to your voice.
Right.
And that's that gravelly vibrato.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know how you develop styles is you sing along and you do something. I have a thing where I do a real wide vibrato as well. And if people tell you, boy, I hate it when you do that, then you quit doing it. If enough people tell you, I really like that,
yeah,
then you find places to put it, you know. And that's what happened. It's a natural thing for me to sing like that and have that gravel in my throat. I don't know why, but it's something. I think it also makes you listen to the lyric more. If it was just this warm, beautiful sound. I don't know that anybody would listen to it. But when you add that gravel to it, it makes you say, wait, hold on, what's he saying now?
But, you know, Andy Williams, yeah. for example, who
good
died recently,
good friend of mine.
Had a rather smooth sounding voice. He really did develop a listenership.
Oh, absolutely.
So, I mean, different kinds of voices.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm just saying that absolutely. In my case, the lyrics I sing are lyrics that require that you listen to them to find the story. So that's all. And I think it's helped me in what I do.
Kenny Rogers, his new memoir titled Luck or Something Like It.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By The Scan Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Charles Dickens created memorable fictional children, Oliver Twist, Tiny Tim, and Little Nell. A new biography explores what happens to his own sons and daughters. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Kenny Rogers is here with me in the studio. We're talking about his new memoir, which I must say is very frank and very open in its, you don't hide any of your warts.
Well, you know, one of the things that I told the people when I was doing it, when I told the publishers, I said, I will not get into it. He said, she said, I don't want to get into the salaciousness of all of this. The reason I did this is Patsy Bales Cox, who was going to be the original writer on the book. You know, they said, give her 20 hours, tell her your stories, and she'll write the book.
Right.
Well, she started writing, and then she developed breast cancer and died. So she couldn't finish the book. And I started reading it, and as wonderful as it was, it wasn't in my voice.
It wasn't you.
It wasn't in my voice. So I took the stories back and started writing them. And I've always been very open about everything that's ever happened to me. Because I think if you tell people, they don't care. You hide it, somebody's going to dig it up.
Absolutely. They'll find it. Here's a fabulous email from David, who says, I was in Rwanda. Wow. In 1994, about a week before the massacre started, in a small village in the most remote part of the mountains, I stayed in a two-room wooden hotel served only as a restaurant and bar for miles. Upon my arrival, the proprietor asked me for two batteries with a small cassette player. He played Kenny Rogers' Lucille over and over again until the batteries wore down.
Wow, I I'm so flattered by those things because I don't get it. I don't know how else to say it. You know, it shocks me. But
what shocks you?
That people that far away would like that song.
Yeah,
I don't know why. You know, but I think it's very flattering, and I'm thrilled with it. But every time I hear a story about someone in a Uganda or somewhere liking my music, I have to just take a deep breath and go, how did that happen, you know?
Now, I guess another element of how did that happen, looking at your face on the cover of this book, which I have always felt was such a handsome face. We have an email from Christine in Baltimore. She says, I do hope we'll hear from Mr. Rogers about the dramatic change in his looks. Is he glad he underwent plastic surgery, and how has it changed things for him?
Well, in answer to your question, I'm glad I did it. I wish the results had been better. But, you know, like I said, I've always been open. I didn't put that in the book, the plastic surgery stuff, because that's all I would have talked about on the shows. And I think there's much more to it, to my life than that. But I'm not ashamed of it. And do I wish I hadn't done it? I don't know what I would have looked like if I hadn't done it. So I have to settle for what I look like now. And I'm not unhappy now. Things have settled down. I think the guy that did my eyes took the edges too high for me, and I didn't like it, and I told him so. So, but, you know, you live and you do things.
Why did you decide to do it?
Because I could afford it. And I think it was, you know, you go through those periods in your life. And I don't think I've ever been afraid of growing old. That's never been a deal with me. But, you know, I went through a thing where, well, what can I do? Can I do this? Can I do that? And I did it, you know.
Did it have something to do with marrying a younger woman?
Oh, no, this was before I met her.
Long before
that, yeah.
I see. So
it was just cosmetic. You know, it's what it is, exactly what it is.
So when you look in the mirror now, do you see Kenny Rogers any differently? Do you think any differently about
I think that's
Kenny
a hard Rogers? Question to answer, because I see what I see, and I've looked like this for 20 years and whatever it is. So I think this is what I look like. I look at old pictures of me, and I see, you know, wonderful lines in my eyes.
You bet.
And do I wish they were still there? Yeah, but would they be lines or bags at this point? So you can't look back. You can't go back. You can't change
it. Do you think your fans would have reacted to you differently, or have they? That because clearly they've noticed.
Well, yeah, but you know what? You don't do it for the fans. You do it for yourself. I mean, I have a life I have to live.
Of course.
And I have to do things for me, and the fans either like it or don't like it, and you can't be responsible for that.
All right, let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
Good morning, Mr. Rogers.
Good morning, Chris.
As a 9-year-old boy, when the movie Six Pack came out, my sister and I had my dad take us to this movie. I think it was something like 6 times, and I absolutely fell in love with the movie. And my question was, did you enjoy working with all the kids and actually acting? And, you know, what was that like?
I absolutely, this is one of my favorite movies to have done. You know, Diane Lane is in there. Michael Anthony Hall is in there. And one of those kids just passed away the other day. They sent me a notice on it. But it was great fun. It was a cute story. You know, that's all it was. And the only thing I didn't like is when I had to go out and save Benji. he was on a raft and Diane floating down the Chattahoochee River, and it was in like January. That water was so cold. I took about four strokes and I said, let me out of here. Send the stunt double in.
I love it.
But it was, you know, it's movies like that are so much fun to do. And I'm so glad I did that. You know, someone was telling me that they said, you know, you're really a very good actor. I said, I'm not there are actors and there are people who can act.
Yeah.
I said, I'm not an actor. An actor can take unbelievable dialogue and make it believable. I can take believable dialogue and keep it believable. I found out I'm really good at being me in different clothes. I can be Western. I was a preacher. I can do all that, but it's still me.
It's you. And Lynn in Johnson City, Tennessee, has a comment for you. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. Thank you for speaking with me.
Surely.
I go way back with, and hello, Kenny.
Hey,
I go way back with you and personally, with the first edition. And I started working in music retail in 1975, so I followed your career from that point on and sold a lot of your records, by the way.
Well, that's very nice. Thanks.
Yes. And anyway, my son is 19 and is a big Dolly Parton fan.
Aren't we all?
As a result of that, he became a huge Kenny Rogers fan. He's 19 years old and, you know, he's a
generation. So I got caught up in the draft.
You got that right. Yes. My question is, are you seeing not only, you know, I'm 57, are you seeing a younger fan base of any sort that has an interest in your music?
Yeah, you know what I'm convinced of? All the people that bought my records played it for their kids, and while it's child abuse, I think those kids are now growing up and enjoying what they heard when they were kids. So it's a great handoff, I think.
Met you, there was peace unknown. I set out to get you with a fine tooth comb. I was soft inside, there was something going on. You do something to me that I can't explain. Hold me closer and I feel no.
Such an interesting rhythm.
You know, the Bee Gees are notorious, and that's the Bee Gees singing background. They are notorious for writing everything on the upbeat. So as an artist, it's hard to sing.
Yeah,
that.
And you know, as a listener, something's going on here.
Yeah.
That's different.
But you know, he wrote the song, and they gave it to me, and I'm in the studio, and I sang this for 4 days. And I finally turned to Barry Gibb and I said, Barry, I don't even like this song anymore. And like an epiphany, I'm that quickly, he says, we need Dolly Parton. And I said, I don't know Dolly, but my manager had just run into her.
Wow.
So he said, let me call her. So 45 minutes later, she walked in the studio and she marched. And, you know, Dolly marches. She doesn't walk. So when she came in the studio, that song was never the same, and I give her full credit for it. And it was so much fun. And it was the beginning of 2 or 3 years of great camaraderie between the two of us.
Islands in the stream, that is what we are. No one in between, how can we be wrong? Sail away with me to another world. To another.
think that Dolly says what she means.
Well, I'm convinced she has no filter. That if she thinks it, it comes out her mouth, you know. And that's the beauty to her, is that, and that's what everybody loves about, you know, I have a theory that we're all three people. I'm who I think I am, I'm who you think I am, and I'm who I really am. And the closer those three are together, the longer your career can last. If you look at Dolly, she's everything she says she is. Look at Willie Nelson. He's everything he says he is. If you look at Johnny Cash, he was everything he said he was. And I'd like to think that I'm that way. And I think that's part of the reason. Nobody likes to get tricked. They don't like to think you're something, find out you're not. And with her, she's everything. If you like her on the radio, you'll love her in person because she's that and more.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I have a sense that your grounding, your background, really lent you that ability to combine those three.
Yeah, well, you know, Patsy Bales Cox, who was writing this, and I have to give Alan Rucker, who came in after the fact and kind of organized this mess, but she said, Kenny, I'm going to give you a secret about writing autobiographies. If they love the boy, they'll like the man. So she said, let's really pay attention to how you became you. And that's what's in the book. It talks about how I got from, what the title really talks about is, I wrote a song called Love or something like it. And we took the title Luck or something like it. And the idea is, I was in jazz for 10 years, avant-garde jazz. And how I went from jazz to the New Christie Minstrels. And overnight, I left on a Friday and started on a Monday. And it was really intricate, difficult music to the simplest form of music. But it was music with a message. And I think that was really important to me. So then when we left the first edition, when we left the New Christie Minstrels, four of us walked out of the middle of it. We left on a Friday and started on a Monday with the first edition. So I've just been so lucky to be in places I've been.
There is another duet that I absolutely adore that you recorded with Lionel Richie.
Oh, I like him.
Lady, I'm your knight in shining armor, and I love you. You have made me what I am, and I am yours. My love, there's so many ways I want to say I love you. Let me hold you in my arms forevermore.
Gather, you're about to record another song with Lionel.
Well, you know, Lionel and I have been friends for 40 years. And the problem with Lionel is his yes is a no, and his no is a maybe. You know, he'll go home and say, I can't believe I agreed to do that. Then he'll find a way out of it. But if he says no, he'll go home and say, I really should have done that. So he told me yes, which scares me a little bit. But it's a song. One of the guys from the Commodores, William King's son, came to see me in California at a show. And he said, Kenny, some of my favorite childhood memories are going when we went to visit you in Georgia. And he said, I realized the other day, you can't make old friends. You either have them or you don't. So I started thinking about that. And I went back to Don Schlitz and we were talking. He said, can I have a shot at writing? One day later, he sent me this song called You Can't Make Old Friends. And Lionel said yes, which means it'll never happen. So.
And you bet it will.
We've already cut the tracks. So I'm going to force him. I'm going to track him down. He's one of my better friends in the business, and I love him with all of his flaws.
And one last portion of a song before we go out. Gotta hear it.
while she lay sleeping. I stay out late at night and play my songs. And sometimes all the nights can be so long.
It's good. Now, what man wouldn't want to say that? And what woman wouldn't want to hear it?
I'd like to hear this all day long.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Oh, I'm so pleased you could come. Now, there are two Mr. Rogers at the top of my list, Fred Rogers and now Kenny.
I'm going to put my sweater on.
All right. You've got a beautiful shirt. The book is called Luck. Or something like it.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.